Hi, I'm Rob, and this is Dad Sofa, a podcast about the things that connect us. Whether it is a rained-off attempt at a trip to the pub, or string theory, a cycle to Cornwall, or a chat in the sea, we talk about the stuff of life, what makes us curious, the stuff that connects everything, the spaghetti of life. Come and join us. Get comfy. This is Dad Sofa.
One of the great releases in life for me involves standing in a room for hours upon end, chopping things into tiny pieces, crushing them up either by hand or with some kind of heavy, blunt or sharp implement, or even a kind of whizzing machine. I usually end up looking like I've had cement poured over me or my clothes. Sometimes the debris is cleaned up and put into a bowl and stored for 24 hours. Then after some preparation, it's all set on fire. Once this has been done, the remnants are usually disposed of within 10 to 20 minutes. After hours of preparation, 10 to 20 minutes is all it ever takes for the family to eat what I have made. Yes, I admit to enjoying cookery. I do have to avoid those very sharp serrated knives that my wife bought to chop things. The problem with the serrations and speed chopping is that serration can sometimes change the course of the blade ever so slightly as it makes progress through the foodstuff, but just enough to remove the tip of a finger or slide into the side of a thumb. I watch people using the notoriously dangerous mandolin, but the quiet that succeeds a mishap, even without the screaming afterwards, is enough to remind me never to go near one. It started for me watching my mother making porridge as a child, seeing the bubbling mixture like the Kurau Park mud pools in New Zealand. Mum was not impressed by my analogy, by the way. She would always add an egg to the porridge, saying that eggs were good for me. Sometimes she would cook things slow, and it gave food flavours that I never experienced again until having a Michelin star meal many years later, and my wife said, "Try this, it tastes amazing." The flavour launched me back to childhood in an instant. I also remember the interesting things that she used. I still have the Bakelite-handled saucepan that she showed me how to cook beans in, the rolling pin that my dad made, turning the piece of wood on a lathe in 1932. The 90-year-old pin is still used to this day for Saturday pizza night. How he would laugh. Other things disappeared, such as the ceramic elephant my mother would put in pies, the trunk sticking out from under the pastry, her explanation, to let the steam out, and the pressure cooker, whose lid blew off, leaving a rather odd stain on the ceiling from the coloured juices that were launched upwards at such great speed, an example of when the steam shouldn't have come out. I'm not sure what it is, but the pursuit of that complex flavour that takes one back to childhood is quite addictive, although I'm not always sure it was. A gradual build of nostalgia can guide how we do things in the future. The brain is a funny thing, but certain smells and tastes definitely ring true. However, there were probably many foods that I despised as a child that I now love, English mustard being one and whiskey being another, although the latter doesn't agree with me, so I rarely drink it these days. My own cooking started unceremoniously with a few goes at sugar bread, brandy snaps and biscuits. I think I felt overwhelmed that so much went into this that I left it until Mum saw the need and taught me how to cook a roux. I then discovered Madame Jaffray and used her techniques to learn Indian cookery. As a house officer working in the hospital service, this gave me many opportunities to cook for people from all parts of the world, and as a result I learned something of the cuisines of Pakistan, India and Iran during this time. When I met my wife and we started stepping out together, we cooked a roast dinner, and the day after we had some spare parsnips and some pasta sauce. We made something that has gone down in our annals as a dish called Parsnip Surprise, one of the most disgusting things that either of us have ever cooked. By the time I returned to Birmingham, cooking on a Friday night became a great way to switch off, a kind of repetitive therapy. Having persisted, I've gone through the pain barrier of learning to make a hollandaise, the path of which is strewn with failed attempts and wasted ingredients. The whole thing has created the kitchen as the hub of our household. Friday night is curry night, and Saturday, pizza. One of my boys has now perfected the dough. Then everyone rolls their own base, with said rolling pin, of course, and adds their own ingredients. We all stare at each other, wondering why they always like that on their pizza. There is the occasional separation of the dough in the oven, due to air developing within, and thus, what was supposed to be a pizza base is taken from the oven, looking more like a whoopee cushion. Then there is a time that somebody put the oven on too high, and a few minutes forgotten led to a ball of thin, crisp brown, a slight touch with the finger and the whole structure demolished into tiny fragments. My grandmother was apparently refractory when it came to cooking. My dad advised me that her rock cakes were only good for playing football with, and she did actually burn a boiled egg. But my mother grew up during the Second World War, a time when food was rationed, but because of that, the overall dietary health of the population improved. She could make something out of any basic ingredients, and I suppose that's what interested me. Christmas for us has now become a procession of different family members, each with their own discipline. The smells of Christmas will create memories for our own children. But in summer, we descend on Simon Stallard's hidden hut, al fresco dining with really beautifully cooked dals and chowders, sitting on the beach with the sounds of the sea, eating from sustainable containers and cutlery. A cooking hero of mine, Heston Blumenthal, was inspired to do his work once he'd read The Science and Law of Cooking by Harold McGee. It breaks down cookery into a chemistry class. There is a whole chapter on milk. As a result, Heston learned to combine flavours that would work for our brains, but on paper would seem confusing or even disgusting, the early examples being snail porridge and bacon and egg ice cream. His cooking feasts are now legendary, but it was a seafood pie that he did which really amazed me. He would serve it in his restaurant with sounds from the beach. There is something in the limbic system of our brains that enables us to transfer sensations of sound and vision within our brains that enhance our sense of taste and smell. So any opportunity to eat near a beach, I take without question. So whether I'm making food, eating it, or simply spectating on others' experiences while watching MasterChef, there is something that excites me about food. A way of giving to each other, putting yourself on the hook, or engaging with your family and friends, even those from the distant past.